a message from a Jewish sage of long ago, the fierce power of love.
One primary, if not the primary, message, as it were, there's much in the book, of course, but is the power of love. This is not something sappy. This is a force. This is a power. And this is a power that can transform. There's one quote. Someone is talking to the Baal Shem Tov, and he is asking, and the Baal Shem Tov, he says, "I'm counseling you to stand rooted in the truth you wish to protect, rather than bent over by fear."
That's Ani Tuzman. She's just come out with a novel based on the life of the 18th century Jewish spiritual master, the Baal Shem Tov. It's called The Tremble of Love. Then we re-air an excerpt from our 2008 interview with Terry Tempest Williams about her book, Mosaic. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net, also at PRX. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The 18th century Jewish spiritual master, Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, is a legendary figure in Jewish history. Best known as the Baal Shem Tov, or the Good Master of the Name, he preached the practice of joy and compassion as the surest way to celebrate God. But the historical record about the Baal Shem Tov is skimpy. He didn't write his teachings down. Instead, he spread his gospel in person to the Jewish communities of the Polish-Lithuanian region. He healed the sick using herbs and amulets, but he also healed minds and souls with his message of love. My guest, Ani Tuzman, takes inspiration from the legend of the Baal Shem Tov to create her richly realized novel, The Tremble of Love. She follows Yisrael's life from his orphan childhood, steeped in the deepest poverty, to the end of his life as an esteemed spiritual leader. The novel shows how this remarkable figure transcended the prejudices of his time to honor women equally with men and Christians as well as Jews. The book contains much contemporary resonance with the dark times we face as the Baal Shem Tov confronts false prophets with his message of the power of love. Well, Ani Tuzman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. I'm so glad to be here.
So this book, The Tremble of Love, is a novel inspired by the legendary spiritual master, Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer. He was known as the Baal Shem Tov. Who was he, and why was he called the Baal Shem Tov?
He started out as a youth that people thought was very strange, unable to read, to learn to read, unable to look people in the eyes when they communicated with him. He was an orphan. And so the prognosis, they didn't use that word, but certainly was not greatness in this being. But as time evolved, and it is all swathed in legend, as the preface of the book says, he had many teachers, was guided to teachers on his path. Among them, no one is sure. And so in the book, I've written based on the legends and also my own intuitions. And there were herbalists, there were Kabbalists, there were rabbis. And above all, he found his greatest teachers to be everyday people, the tradespeople in the marketplace, the people who didn't know how to read and write. He called those his greatest teachers. And so he learned about the human heart, about human suffering, about kindness. And it's not clear, you know, nowadays for some time there have been ordinations, official ordinations of rabbis. Smicha is the name. And it's not clear when he had official smicha. In the book, I describe it as really the people starting to call him rabbi. And so his ordination came from the very people in the marketplace, in the roads, on the farms, on the land. He was a healer and did use herbs. He did also use that. So the word Baal Shem, now we're coming to that.
But before we get further into this, first tell us, when did he live and where did he live?
He lived in the 18th century. He was born just before the turn of the century in 1698. In what was called the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, now is the Ukraine.
Okay, so he lived there. What was that society like for Jews at that time?
There were various classes of Jews, and of course there was anti-Semitism, and there was a place for Jews in the society. Jews had certain roles they played and certain roles they weren't allowed to play. There were Jews that were tradespeople. There were Jews could not own land, but they were often leaseholders. They often served, one of the things that got them in trouble was they often served as tax collectors for the nobility. So, and also the nobility that owned taverns, the Jews ran the taverns, and the Jews often collected the taxes. These were roles that they played. And there were extreme paupers. There were those that did trade and textile trade or gems from the Ottoman Empire. So there were many social classes, and there were limits on the rights and the roles of Jews. The Jews had their own governing councils in the towns and villages. They were under Polish law, of course, but they also had, there was Jewish law, and they could ordain, they could make determinations. There were Jewish courts.
So before we go too much further about the Baal Shem Tovim, you've talked about him being somebody who was a peculiar person as a boy. But I think our listeners would like to know, how did you get interested in the story? Because I read somewhere that you actually experienced an inner call to write about the Baal Shem Tov, who was a spiritual master.
I did. I had heard of the Baal Shem Tov all my life. My parents survived the Holocaust, and so Eastern Europe and what happened to the legacy of Judaism and the Jewish people there was a topic that was always in the foreground of my mind. So, and at some point in my own journey, I studied in a yeshiva with rabbis, and I had heard of the Baal Shem Tov for years. And I had a book on my shelf. I believe it was the only book in English at the time, for many years. And it was a translation of legends about the Baal Shem Tov. And I would periodically pick it up and was so taken. The two primary things that took me were his joy and his, what I began to call his equal vision, the way he regarded all people, women, children, the poor, people who were not Jewish, as worthy and equal. So that he was there always. And then I did experience an inner call. I had just finished another book, and I was meditating, and I experienced, however that works, wherever that comes from deep within, I experienced a call to write a book about him and his teachings. And I saw right away, I'm not a scholar, and I apprehended that it was to be a novel. And I said yes immediately inside. And then I said, but you can do much better than me. There are famous Jewish writers. And I heard some answers as to why me. And one of them was, you said yes. And Many years later, I remembered something that's in the Torah, and the words are Na'aseh v'nishma, they're Hebrew, and they mean roughly, we'll do it and then you explain. So yes, and then you explain. And I realized that that moment was a Na'aseh v'nishma moment. I said, oh my God, yes, of course. And then I said, but... But now the promise is fulfilled.
That's wonderful. So the Baal Shem Tov, first of all, what does the name mean?
That's what I was just coming to before. So Baal Shem is literally a master of the name. The plural in Hebrew is Baalei Shem. So there were many. This was a common practice. There were individuals, primarily men. Men are all that were written about. I believe there were women doing this as well. And they used amulets they used herbs and other things as well. But Baal Shem, the word Shem, name, it's referring to the divine name. And so they used amulets to heal. And they would place these on parts of the body. They would repeat the divine name. There was always usually, as far as my research reveals, there was a physical component, an amulet, often written on parchment, but also the recitation of the names. And so this is one of the things Yisrael did. He was a Baal Shem. He practiced healing using the name. Over time, he became known as the Baal Shem Tov. The word Tov means good. So there are two ways this has been translated. One is the good master of the name, and the other is the master of the good name. But the distinction was he's the only one that was called the Baal Shem Tov. And this was a reflection of that there was something about this Baal Shem that was different than the others, because there were hundreds of them throughout Eastern Europe and perhaps other parts of Europe that practiced and that did healing, and he was distinguished from those.
And he seems like an almost Christ-like figure in your book, The Tremble of Love, with a message that is just completely grounded in love. I kept on thinking that the way he preaches, the way he, as you said, he has this idea that everyone is worthy. He treats everybody equally. Did you make that connection as well?
Of course. Of course. Of course I did.
So what's your take on that?
Well, I was thinking about that earlier. I was having a conversation with someone about the current political situation, and I was later on reflecting about fear and love. And love, one primary, if not the primary message, as it were, there's much in the book, of course, but is the power of love. This is not something sappy. This is not a nice word. This is a force. This is a power. And this is a power that can transform. There's one quote. Someone is talking to the Baal Shem Tov, and he says, he is asking, and the Baal Shem Tov, he says, I'm counseling you to stand rooted in the truth you wish to protect rather than bent over by fear. I urge you to strengthen your faith while remaining vigilant. And the individual says, but how, Rabbi? And this line is so, he says, instead of focusing on the misuse of power, employ your vigilance to go deeper into yourself to find your true power. And I think that message, and that message then, that message now, and it's a timeless message. And so the contemplation, what is the power of love, and what is it to love moment to moment, and what is it to love in times that are dark? What is that love that he's summoning that he embodied, that he called forth in extremely dark and painful conditions in those times.
Yeah, talk more about those conditions. I mean, you describe one of the characters is arrested for what was called the blood libel, the accusation that she killed a child in order to make the matzah for Passover. This was not an unusual thing. So talk about those terrible times that he existed in then.
Blood libel was one of many, one crucial accusation common against Jews that the story told, or the threat or to Jews, was that it was said that when Passover approached, Jews needed the blood of Christian children to make their matzahs. And so this was, of course, fabricated. And what would happen is Jews were seized and tortured, and they were told that if they gave the names of other Jews, they would save their lives, or if they converted, they would save their lives. And not go into the gory details, there was tremendous torture involved, and there was great suffering, and some in their fear did name other Jews who, of course, hadn't done such a thing. And they, in the end, weren't saved either. So there are many stories. This is for centuries, not just in the 1700s, but that had gone on. So that was one thing. And of course, even within the Jewish community, hunger, suffering, there's always human suffering.
But you refer to a particular that in his time, just as you made the connection to, you know, in our time, I mean, there's always suffering, but there's sometimes that are scarier than others.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, as we said, one specter always was the blood libel, and just random reasons to attack the Jews, just random reasons to make them scapegoats. But also, the book takes place about 50 years after something cataclysmic in that area, and that they were called it, the pronouncing it is always tricky, but the Chelmnyeki massacres or uprisings, and there were some suffering and disenfranchised peasants who were led by Bogdan Chelmnyeki, and their targets really were the Polish noblemen, but they couldn't get to them. As I say in the book, they lived in fortresses and castles. And so they tried, but the Jews, as tax collectors and middle people, became the target. And so whole villages were massacred. Terrible things, forms of torture and massacre. Now, this isn't in the exact time of the book, but the specter of that time is very present in the book. And the influence of that despair, and then a false messiah that arose shortly after. And in the time of the book, another false messiah arises.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that, because the history appears here as a great influence of a man who claimed that he was the messiah, Sabbatai Tzvi. I wonder if you could talk about false messiahs and true messiahs. Well, we can't really say the Baal Shem Tov was a messiah, but false leaders and true leaders, because it seems to me that that's another very resonant theme in this book. And we are talking with Ani Tusman. She is the author of a new novel based on the life of the Baal Shem Tov, and it is called The Tremble of Love.
Great point about false leaders and true leaders. So we just spoke about the false messiah Sabbatai Tzvi that arose on the heels of the Chelmnyeki uprisings. And one of the teachings, his teachings, and then subsequently Jacob Frank, who came to the fore in the 1700s, was that they drew on messianic teachings, and they said that in order for there to come an age of peace and redemption, there needed to be great chaos first. And so There was much of that in both of their teachings. One thing that also comes to mind in terms of the question of true and false leaders, and there's research now that's coming forth more that and that's come forth. Both of these individuals, there's reason to believe that there was mental illness. And in Shabtai Tzvi, the words didn't exist, but manic depressive. He had episodes of immense depression and then exaltation. And what's amazing is how someone can take power or become a powerful figure who is so deeply flawed, so profoundly flawed. And so the question, I mean, there are answers in a sense in the novel, but of course any work of literature needs to also pose deep questions. And so one question one might say is that how is it that a flawed leader can gain a following? How is it that a flawed leader can assume power, great power? And in the end, can such a leader triumph? Or in the end, putting it somewhat simplistically, does love and truth triumph? And how are we then part of that? And that's part of what the book is examining, is reflecting. How are we in the face of the abuse of power? In this, by, for example, Jacob Frank, the leader that is said to be the reincarnation of Shabtai Tzvi, the Sabbatean leader in the 1600s. How is it that an individual responds in their life and as part of a community to the abuse of power? And also looking inside oneself for what is it, what was it, for example, back to the historical period of the book, what was it that drew people, this is a question that's looked at, to follow a leader like Shabtai Tzvi in the 1600s, and what calls people again to be drawn to a leader like Jacob Frank?
Or Donald Trump.
Yes, I'm not saying that, but yes. What is the desperation? What are the illusions? What is it? So that inner searching, and of course some people who are follow might not do that inner searching, but it behooves all of us who can to look inside and try to fathom. I mean, one of the main teachings of the Baal Shem Tov was compassion. That's not pity. And he strongly says in many scenes in the book, that's not indifference, that's not passivity. But what does it mean for us now, for example, to be in this time period in touch with love and compassion that is not passivity, that is not sugarcoating, that is none of those things, but that is a dynamic force that I would say, and the Baal Shem Tov taught, is the greatest force, the greatest force.
And you, this is something you treat in this book, Ani Tusman, in this novel, The Tremble of Love, as the concept of devekut.
Yes, devekut, or dvekut, it's both ways.
You say it's a core concept of Jewish mystical tradition, and this is something we haven't really touched on yet, the role of mysticism, the Kabbalah. Tell us about devekut as a concept of Jewish mystical tradition, and explain to us what it is and how it is expressed in this novel.
So the word dvekut has as its root, it's often defined as cleaving, but it's not such a contemporary word. So in the book, I actually describe it as remembrance. So its definition, I think the root is even the word glue, or to glue oneself, or to connect oneself to the truth, to, again, in my author's note in the beginning of the book, I say something about the word God and people being able to use whatever word, whether it's from another religious tradition or no religious tradition at all, but to connect oneself, to remember, to root oneself in that call it presence, call it being, call it God, call it Allah, call it Shekhinah. There's so many names for the one, for that remembrance, for that truth. So the concept of Dvekut is to remember, is to, as I said, to root oneself. That image is a strong image throughout the book, the rooting in love, the rooting in remembrance. And that image is so powerful when the winds blow or the waves are intense and we lose our balance. And so Dvekut is a practice. And some people call it the practice of presence, the practice of, I mean, can even in contemporary practice, the power of now, the power of being in the moment and remembering.
And doesn't it also have something to do with the connection we have with each other?
Well, yes, of course, because that when we are remembering, when we are connecting that way, what we're seeing that in each other, that's part of inherent in that process is we see that love in each other and we're connecting. If it's okay, it's funny, just before the call, sometimes I take the novel and I just open it. And I did that before the call. And someone is asking Yisroel about the abuse and some particularly powerful figures that are challenging Yisroel and demeaning him and threatening him. And he says, yes, I do see and have heard the accusations that concern you. And he says, goes on to say, my focus is the man or woman before me, her anguish, his pain, their beauty, their need and desire to be reminded of who they are. And when I read that passage again, I thought again of now, in our time, and many of us feeling powerless, many of us struggling not to be overtaken by fear or by anger. Not that those energies don't have a place, I'm not saying that, but here, what I just read is one of the possible responses, which is how, just what you just asked. How are we present with our neighbors? How are we present even with those with whom we disagree with? How are we present to each other's fears and pain and needs? And what does that mean in a moment-to-moment, day-to-day way? And that's much of what we see in the novel, in the Baal Shem Tov interacting.
Now, we are airing this just prior to Hanukkah. Hanukkah this year starts very close to Christmas. I believe it's Christmas Eve. Miracles, the miracle of the lights, is a theme of Hanukkah. I wonder if you could talk about miracles and the Baal Shem Tov.
I want to say one thing, though, about Hanukkah, that's another major theme of Hanukkah that's so timely now, is the theme of Hanukkah of the few, the righteous few, the few being able to triumph in the face of invincible odds. A few coming to restore a temple to its dignity, not a place of commerce, but to restore it to its original integrity, being challenged by the entire Roman army, a small tribe. And that message is so profound at this time.
The Greek army.
But that message of the few in the face of what appear to be invincible odds, and connected to the light. So that rings back to the Dvekut. There were many, the Baal Shem Tov was described as a miracle worker. And many of the legends describe miracles, the Baal Shem Tov appearing to more than one person at the same time. And it's very interesting because there are different ways to understand those miracles. The longing of the heart can manifest to us the appearance of love or grace in our lives. And so there are many, many ways to understand the miracles. The Baal Shem Tov didn't describe himself as a miracle maker, as a miracle worker. All the credit, as it were, went to love, went to the longing of an individual to heal or to know the truth or to serve their family. And so he didn't describe himself as making miracles. He didn't describe himself in any way remotely as superior or more special or different. And I think that's also the hallmark of a true teacher, and a true in many traditions we can see that the teacher arises to be a reflection, not to be better than or other than, but to reflect the inner truth and the heart of those around the teacher, not to be singled out or to be worshipped. None of that was what the Baal Shem Tov sought or reinforced or asked for.
So finally, you've talked about the Baal Shem Tov as an inspiration for us now, not just in a time of Hanukkah, but in a time of great uncertainty and fear about the future. You have something in the book, or I read it somewhere, I have this in my notes, that he suggested that no leader or catastrophe precedes the final age or must precede the final age. Rather, we could hasten the coming of an age of peace by practicing peace now.
Yeah.
I wonder, what do you mean by no leader must precede the final age? And, you know, tell us why that's in there.
Well, first of all, it's not actually, I believe, that the Baal Shem Tov taught there would be no leaders. But the line in the book, when he's asked about a messianic age, he replies, "I believe that we hasten the coming of an age of peace by practicing peace now. Will an individual arise to lead us into a realm where, as it is written, the lion can lie down with the lamb? I don't know. What if the world to come is this world, transformed by our love and respect for one another? What if the messianic age of peace is actually a way of being with each other moment to moment now?" A way, and that's a profound message throughout the book. How we are moment to moment with each other and what it means to practice love. Not just as words, but what does that really mean? What does it mean to practice peace? What does it mean to practice living in the world and creating a world that's the world we want to see?
Well, Ani Tuzman, your novel of the Baal Shem Tov is The Tremble of Love, and it is a beautiful book. When did it come out? It came out a few weeks ago, is that right?
The official launch, the official release was December 6th, and it's available in print editions and, of course, ebook versions.
And it's your first novel.
It is. But not my last, God willing.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you again.
Thank you, Francesca. Thank you so much.
Ani Tuzman. Let's hear her read an excerpt from her novel, The Tremble of Love.
A passage from The Tremble of Love, a novel of the Baal Shem Tov. In this passage, Yisroel, who is to become the Baal Shem Tov, is having a conversation with his brother-in-law Gershon, a noted rabbi, highly esteemed rabbi, who's deeply worried about the attacks against Yisrael and also about events that are happening in the Commonwealth. Yisrael is speaking. I'll be reading some excerpts from their conversation. There are many ways to dispel darkness, my brother. I judge none of them. My way to dispel the darkness has become to focus on the light. It is not merely my choice. It has become impossible for me not to see the light. In the darkness of despair, ignorance, hatred, vengeance, and even in violence, I see light. I believe the human soul is both a brightness more blinding than the sun and a tiny spark that can be swallowed by darkness. My attention to each spark adds to its light. The essence of this attentiveness is love. Love feeds and amplifies the light, and love illumines the dark, whether the darkness of circumstances or the despair in a man's own mind. Is it not a comfort to know that darkness can only obscure light for a time, but ultimately not extinguish it? From an early age, without trying or wanting to, I found myself able to feel the anguish of others, gripping cold, hunger, a burning fever, heartbreaking grief, the terror induced by the Khmelnytsky massacres. I couldn't help wondering why God would permit such brutality in human suffering. My doubt tore sharply at what I thought might be my illusion of God. My doubt was finally vanquished in a crucible of suffering that almost vanquished me. I felt the torment of human suffering in every cell of my being, as if my body was humanity's body. I was burned from the inside out by a fire defying description. To be annihilated, I thought, would be a blessing. But something within prevented me from begging to be spared, even when it meant losing consciousness and waking to further anguish. I faced the human capacity for cruelty and destruction. At the same time, I experienced the inherent desire of life to endure and flourish. Perhaps this is what a soul is, a spark of pure impulse to live and thrive. Nonetheless, we have to choose again and again. A man can close his eyes and only perceive darkness. A woman can close her heart and only know hatred and terror. Or we can choose to focus on the light and increase it. This choice is at the heart of being human.
Ani Tuzman reading an excerpt from The Tremble of Love. You can read the first chapter of the book by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Terry Tempest Williams talks about finding beauty in a broken world. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Talking with Ani Tuzman put me in mind of another interview I did in 2008 with naturalist and writer Terry Tempest Williams. She had just come out with her book, Mosaic, Finding Beauty in a Broken World. I sat down with her at Mount Holyoke College, where she'd come to give a talk about the book. Let's listen to this excerpt from our 2008 episode with Terry Tempest Williams. It's all too easy to despair these days. War and violence, environmental, economic, and human catastrophes overwhelm us. Where can we find the strength we need to face the crises? Where can we find the creativity we need to solve them? Maybe art can fortify us, open a way to healing. That's what Terry Tempest Williams tells us in her new book, Mosaic, Finding Beauty in a Broken World. Williams starts her book in Ravenna, Italy, where she took a workshop to learn the art of mosaic. She was to put that learning to use later in Rwanda, working alongside survivors of the genocide to build a memorial to its victims. She links the two journeys with another journey to Utah to study the last wild prairie dog communities in America, communities that are part, she says, of a critical and critically endangered ecological mosaic. Mosaic is her metaphor. When I asked her how her metaphor of mosaic came to her, she told me it all started after September 11, 2001, when she found her creative inspiration drying up.
I think the thing that terrified me, Francesca, as much as this administration's environmental policies and that we were marching toward war, was the fact that my own rhetoric had become as hollow and brittle as those I was opposing. I really had lost my own sense of poetry. I was in Maine. It was almost a year to the date. I went down to the waters on that beautiful rocky coast, call it a plea or a prayer, and I asked the sea for one wild word. And the word that the sea rolled back to me, the word that I heard in my own heart, was mosaic. And I think this book began there. I'll be honest, I was disappointed. I thought, great, I'm relegated to a life of crafts, which I don't do well. You know, I thought it was about taking your mother's plates, shattering them, making bad picture frames. That was my ignorance. What I would learn in Ravenna in signing up for a mosaic workshop, I took the word literally, was that this was a very high-level, sophisticated course for restorers, conservators, and I was relegated to the corner breaking stone. What I learned in those 3 weeks is that mosaic is an art form and a form of integration. That mosaic is about taking that which is broken and creating something whole. That the first and last rule of mosaic is light. And I could never have imagined that one wild word would have led me to look at prairie dogs as an ecological mosaic in my home ground of the Colorado Plateau in the Red Rock Desert of Utah. And I could never have imagined that it would have ultimately led me to creating a genocide memorial with survivors, creating a mosaic even out of the rubble of war.
And the mosaic, you say, is the play of light on a broken surface. And you carry this metaphor through as well. Could you say just a little bit more about that before we go on and delve right into the experience that you did have with that?
In a very practical way. You know, when the ancient hands of mosaic from Mesopotamia, from Byzantia, even in the town of Ravenna, placed these square glass cubes known as tessera on these bejeweled ceilings, they're irregular, they're rough. The idea is that this surface does create light to create a heightened sense of worship. There's a powerful metaphor there. You know, another rule of mosaic is that there is perfection and imperfection. I think on some level we're all broken. You know, how does light dance across our own surfaces? How do we find beauty in a broken world? And it's certainly a question that I'm asking myself now as we're in this election season, as we watch the economy tumble, as we are a nation that is still at war, which we seem to forget, even in this political conversation. So I think this whole 8-year journey was holding that question, finding beauty in a broken world. Where? How? And for me, finding beauty in a broken world has become creating beauty in the world we find.
This doesn't usually happen to me, but I find tears are coming to my eyes as you're speaking, because this is something that is always just below the surface for us, the brokenness of our world, and how do we find a way in it?
Yeah, and there are days I don't know, you know, and I'm aware in those days where I can hardly get out of bed, you know, and I don't think I'm alone in those feelings. I'm aware of the limits of my own imagination. What I think I found in Rwanda as being part of a team with Lily Ye, this extraordinary Chinese-American artist whose medium is mosaic, is that imagination's shared collaboration. And collaboration creates community. And in community, I believe anything is possible. And what we saw in the most broken of landscapes, Rwanda, where, as you remember, you know, almost 1 million Tutsis were murdered in 100 days by hand by Hutu extremists, machetes, farm tools, hoes. There we were, Hutus, Tutsis, Americans, Rwandans, working side by side, making mosaics from the shattered shards of war, war reimagined. This was where the mothers brought the bones of their children that were being held in swaths of fabric beneath their beds to be buried properly, lovingly, to remember never again.
So tell us, how did you get there? Actually, you were asked by Lily Ye, tell us who she is, and also you weren't all that sure you wanted to go to begin with.
I had made a pilgrimage to visit Lily Ye. I remember it was in March of 2003, right before the occupation, our occupation of Iraq. I had read about her. It's hard to even find the words. She is such a global citizen. She is a change maker, a builder, a force for good. And she created, with others, in some of the roughest neighborhoods of Philadelphia, the Village of Arts and Humanities. She was asked by a friend, an African-American dancer, if she would help create art in a very broken landscape. And as she tells the story, she went. There were so many vacant lots filled with glass and rubble. And she took a stick, drew a circle from where she was standing, and thought, I will begin here. And she looked around, and there were children. And she said to the children, help me create a sculpture. And the children were picking up these broken pieces. And suddenly she realized, we can do something with mosaic. To make a long story shorter, there was a gentleman named Big Man, known as one of the most successful drug dealers. He became her chief mosaicist, was honored in London before he passed away from cancer as being a world artist. And together, they created these beautiful murals, one of which is called An Isle of Angels, Angel Alley. You know, 12-foot Ethiopian angels that create this safe pathway so that if the children are ever in danger or fear, they know to go there. There will be adult with these mosaic angels to watch over them. A tree of life. Any house that has a red arrow of mosaic knows, people know that that is a safe harbor. You know, just extraordinary transformation through art. We often think art is peripheral, optional. What I have learned from Lily Ye, and especially in Rwanda, especially in this genocide survivors village in Rugerera, is that art is not optional, but a strategy for survival.
And if anywhere you would think that the choice between art and survival could be made, it would be there. I mean, describe some of the brokenness of the land that you found.
You know, and I think that's part of the reason what you were alluding to, I didn't want to go. When Lily asked me, my brother had just passed away, our own family was broken, I was broken, and she said, will you come with me to Rwanda to be my scribe? I'm building a team. We're calling ourselves Barefoot Artists. I said no. I didn't want to go to a country so familiar with death. I didn't want to go to a country where I was complicit in what happened. We as Americans turned our backs while our president, Bill Clinton, debated for those 3 months that the killing was going on whether or not these acts constituted a genocide. I was afraid. She never took her eyes off of me. I said no, and then I said yes. I think on some fundamental level, I realized my own humanity depended on it. We're so isolated, we're so removed, but to actually go to Rwanda, to witness the land there that is so beautiful. I mean, you feel like you are in the crowns of mountains. You know, these beautiful steep hillsides, green. The most beautiful of people in these exquisite markets. But then you look into the eyes of the women. What is unspoken? The losses. On such a scale, it is hard for us to even imagine. I remember Lily Ye and I and Alan Jacobson and Megan Morris, the four Barefoot Artists that went over, we were standing on the edge of a mass grave, 30,000 individuals, bones still exposed, a children's rib by our feet. There's no words. I think what we came away with is we are capable of creating great acts of compassion and tremendous acts of brutality. On one hand, angels, on the other hand, demons. How do we bring our two hands together in prayer?
And you said we with that. There's a common humanity across that entire spectrum.
You know, I think it's very easy to hear the rhetoric of separation. You know, it was a civil war, it's Hutus against Tutsis, it does not concern us. It does concern us. These seeds of discontent and violence were sown in colonialism. We could have made a difference in this country by 2,000 peacekeepers. We did nothing. It wasn't in our political interest. We had just come off of Black Hawk Down in Mogadishu. We were in Serbia. You know, what does Rwanda have that we need? Certainly not oil. We turned our backs. Again, it is our shared humanity. What I remember James Baldwin reading some of his work, and he said something to the effect, whatever my fellow human can do, so can I, in the best sense, in the worst sense. And so therefore, I think we did see these acts in terms of our own humanity, what we're capable of. And I think what we left with is that Rwanda is in the midst of an extraordinary reconstruction. They are learning how to forgive, not to forget. They are learning how to reconstruct their lives, to reconstruct their cities, even a genocide survivor's village.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Terry Tempest Williams about her newest book, Mosaic, Finding Beauty in a Broken World. You had a translator named Lewis, and he says at one point that he wants to forgive, but he says forgiving is forgetting, so he needs to find another word. Is there another word, or is there a place? What did you find about that? How did you explore that place between forgiving and forgetting?
You know, Francesca, I would love to read that passage because I think Louis says it so eloquently, and it's in the context of an extraordinary story that he tells. I want to tell you a story, says Louis, as we sit on Mama Chukula's porch, where we met almost 2 years ago. And I should say, at this point, he is 22 years old, a genocide survivor, has not been to school since the third grade, speaks six languages. There is a woman who was married to a pastor. It was a happy family. Some people say they were a family of six. Others say they were 11. The woman was away, and when she returned, she saw how the Interahamwe were butchering her children on the ground, along with her husband. After the war, the man who murdered her family came back from the Congo, and when the Gachacha courts called him to explain what he had been accused of, he said, "I accept everything I have been charged with, and from the depth of my heart, I apologize." The woman said, "I saw what you did. I saw everything that happened. I know you killed my family. I loved my children and my husband. I am alone now. I have nothing. But I now choose to forgive you and take you into my home. You will live with me, and I will do whatever it takes to make you feel like my own son." "Can you be in the same shoes with this woman?" Louis asks. Louis then says, "Rwanda is struggling with peace, one person at a time. This is as hard as growing wheat on rock. We are finding our way toward unity and reconciliation on a walkway full of thorns, and we are walking barefoot." He stands up and walks over to the balcony that overlooks Gisenyi and the Congo where he was born. "We are trying to forgive, but to forgive is to forget, and we cannot forget. Perhaps there is another word. I am looking for that word."
That's so powerful. I wondered if I could do what that woman did.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine. And in further conversation with Louis and many of the women in the village who have lost everything, one of the women I remember in particular, Speciosa, 70 years old, lost five of her children. She and her husband survived, which she said is worse. You know, she said she forgave the killers because if she doesn't, then they've killed her too.
Louis was more to you than just a translator. In fact, he called upon you to make a commitment you had never been able to make before. Could you say something about that and what the outcome of that was?
And now you make me weep. Louis Gakumba is now our son. I don't even have the words. It's a long story. I talk about some of it in the book. He was our translator. We became very close. He was my eyes, ears, heart. In whatever way I was able to get below the surface in a very foreign landscape, it was because of his translations. He wanted to go to school. We were able to find him a scholarship at the Salt Lake Community College. It was very tough getting a visa, especially with our State Department. They were saying, you know, his commitment to Rwanda isn't deep enough because he doesn't own a home, he doesn't own land, he doesn't have money. In correspondence, it was, let's look at what he does have. Courage, tenacity, hope, you know, service. Anyway, I became very good friends with the consulate. She was an extraordinary woman. But it was Louis. He, 10 hours, would hitchhike up to Kigali and just sit outside her office. His visa had been denied 3 times. If you're denied a 4th, that's it. She called. She said, would you be willing to put your name on his passport and take responsibility should anything go awry? Of course, we went back to Rwanda. I called. I said, where are we on Louis Gakumba's visa? She said he picked it up yesterday. Brooke and I, my husband, we went down to the village. Unbeknownst to us, Francesca, we found ourselves in a transfer ceremony with his parents. His mother, such an exquisite woman. And she held my hands, looked into my eyes, and just said, we are Louis' biological parents. You are now his developmental parents. Please help him to find an education. And, you know, it was just one of those moments in your life where you just go with it, with an open heart. And Louis has been our greatest blessing. And I know he will go back to Rwanda and do extraordinary things. And I feel, again, it's that one wild word. I could never have imagined that that word, that plea to retrieve my poetry would have led us to a reconfiguration of family, even a son.
Terry Tempest Williams talking with us in 2008 about her book, Mosaic, Finding Beauty in a Broken World. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.